You are listening to 15 Minutes, the show with Osiris Munir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, what's going on? It's me, Osiris, with 15 Minutes, the show. Now, someone just asked me, is the show only 15 minutes? I had to get a brief rundown. We used to be 15 minutes. Now we've gone the LA Talk Radio show format. We go 50. So we're going, I should say, from 15 to 50. You know what I mean? Maybe that would make more sense. But at any rate, I wanted to say happy holidays to everybody out there. I know it's been an intense end of a year. There's a lot going on, a lot being unveiled that's been hidden. So everybody that's got any little dark secrets, if I were you, I would stay, you know, and be honest with yourself and others. Also, it looks like all of the chickens are coming home to roost and then some. Again, someone asked me, I'm going to explain this one more time before we talk about the guest. From a Buddhistic perspective, karma, these words get thrown around very loosely in the environment. Karma is so much more deeper than just what comes around, goes around, comes around. It is an energetic field that is built and developed over time and from moment to moment encounters with everything. So from the time you wake up, everything that we encounter builds and constructs our inner person, our inner world, our inner self. And karma is what, if we do a lot of good things, then chances are when something crucial comes up in our personal lives, we have enough money in our fortune bank account to use. That means something, you know, you'll be elevated. But if you are a person doing things, or people, groups, individuals, whatever, doing things that are they're dark, they're underhanded, they're behind the scenes, they're meant to destroy people and all that, I feel bad for you, not so much for the people that you're trying to do it to, because it just doesn't work like that. Things come back, you know, and they follow us over time. They affect generations, our families, etc. So today, I want to make a quick announcement. Yes! Yes! We have a sponsor. Yay! Certified Senior Real Estate and Probate Specialist Kevin Pike of Coldwell Banker. Yay, Kevin got on board supporting me and my show. So in order to reach Kevin, he will take care of anything. I just said he's a specialist at everything. So call him at 818-571-1508. That's 818-571-1508. And now for our guest. Guess what, you guys? I am talking to an author, a writer, a tabloid bad boy, and I want to see how low and dirty we gonna go today. His name is William Keck. I like to call him Will. Hey, Will. Hey.
Hey, Osiris. What was all that you just said about if you're living dark and dirty and if you're sabotaging and causing trouble?
Yeah, if you're doing anything like that, then I feel bad for the people doing it, not so much the people that they're trying to do it to. Because a lot of people are innocent, you know what I mean? And they go around and people point at them and they're innocent. Like, you know, you can't attack innocent people. Like, take care of your own stuff, you know, take care of your own stuff internally, you know? So that's what I'm talking about.
That was me 30 years ago.
Ooh, let's talk. Because I heard, wait a minute, you guys, this man right here that I'm having the wonderful pleasure of talking to, he ran down in a high-speed chase Britney Spears and Elizabeth Taylor. I mean, dangerous. Like, I don't know. I guess imagine driving on the side of the car, hanging out with a camera or something. And then he's also known for infiltrating, like just busting in and getting in celebrity weddings and all that stuff and not getting kicked out. So I want to know how low and dirty we going to go today about what you've been doing.
As low and dirty as we can go.
Well, let's make it filthy.
And I should clarify that the high-speed chase with Britney Spears and Elizabeth Taylor, the two ladies were not in the same car. It was
okay.
Two separate high-speed chases.
Okay.
But how great would that have been if Liz and Brittany
would have been together,
were going out in the town together? I mean, wow, right?
Talk, how did you do, I mean, first of all, how in the world do you get past all the securities and the guards and the velvet ropes and the this rope and the that section and the this important? How do you do it? How did you do it?
Well, I got to tell you, so I've been a celebrity reporter for the past 30 years, but The Inquirer was only a three-year period in my life, and that was in my early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not look like what you would imagine sort of a sleazy tabloid reporter to look like. I was some fresh-faced kid with kind of an opie smile just showing up on people's doors. And boy, you know what? It worked for me. People kind of were surprised that I was working for the Inquirer, and it got me quite far. I was able to sneak into weddings and funerals and hospital rooms and get the goods.
And so, but you worked for some other magazines too. I mean, I know, I remembered something about the release that your public person, PR person did such a great job, Harlan. Hey, Harlan. Anyway, did such a great job discouraging your cringe-worthy confessions of, like, you got the first interview fresh off the bat with Nicole Brown Simpson's family right after the murder and all that. And that must have been, I can't imagine how raw someone would feel for someone to have to come and talk to you after such a tragic. What can you say something about that?
Yeah, you know, and I mean, I want to make clear that these are my confessions.
Okay.
I'm not proud of a lot of these things that I did. I'm kind of coming clean. I'm apologizing to those who are still alive, who I'm able to. A lot of the book is very funny. There's some really crazy fun adventures that didn't cause harm to people. But the story you're talking about, yeah, when I was at the Inquirer, it was during the OJ trial. And I was sent by my ruthless editors to try to get the first interview with Nicole's family just 3 days after she had been laid to rest.
Mm.
And the Brown family live in a gated community down in Orange County. And I tried grocery deliveries and flower deliveries. Ultimately, I went to the Ritz-Carlton. I hopped a fence. I ran on the beach in a suit and tie. Another wall. I went to the front door. The housekeeper answered the door and led me into a room where Nicole's mother and three sisters were seated around a photograph of Nicole crying.
Oh.
And Mrs. Brown took my hand and said, "Thank you so much for coming. How did you know my Nicole?"
Mm. So she thought and you were somebody that they knew.
She thought I was a friend. Friends have been coming to pay their respects all day. And she thought I was one of them. And I told the truth. I said, "I'm so sorry for this invasion of privacy. I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm with the Inquirer." And they were shocked, obviously, but she said, you went to all this trouble to get into our home. What do you want?" And I didn't have an answer for this. I never thought I would get this far.
So I said
the right thing. I said, "I guess I'd like to know how you told your grandchildren that their mommy was gone."
Wow.
And I think the question got to her. Up until this point, there had been so much emphasis on OJ, on the perpetrator, that people were ignoring the victims. So she was already very anxious to tell her daughter's story. And she gave me a lovely story about how she sat the children down and said that mommy is now an angel, but you're always going to have four mommies looking out for you. And your mother will always be with you. And we printed the story exactly as she told it to me. The Browns, although of course they felt invaded, they appreciated that we told their story honestly. And that set up a relationship between the Browns and the Inquirer that lasted for several years.
Wow. You know,
yeah.
Now I'm going to ask you this. I'm going to ask it in a way I hope it doesn't sound weird. But as you were doing all of these things, do you think that if you had been another color, it would have been a lot harder for you to do that? Or do you think it's because you had that all-American classic look, the suit, the tie, you know, you didn't look like you were about to rob somebody or that you've been drinking all night or whatever. What do you think got you past, if it were that at all, if it were any of those things?
I let's be honest, you're absolutely right. I mean, 100%. I mean, this is years before we started to right the wrongs with Black Lives Matter and having more equality in production studios and in the media. So, yeah, I mean, I think a little innocent, nerdy white boy showing up on some rich celebrity's front door, I got a little bit further. I think that there totally would have been racism and people would have not opened the door. Let's be real. When I was at the Inquirer, we had I think they brought in a couple reporters of color, and initially they were assigned to Black celebrity stories.
Yeah.
So they had the Oprah beat or the Cosby beat. So they proved themselves, and they were then given access to all different celebrities of different colors. But yeah, no, I think absolutely I was able to get more access because of just the color I was born.
And also your hands, you know, I know that people don't think this, but being good looking in Hollywood, any of those places, it does help you. I mean, it doesn't mean that you, some people, personality and looks are like a bubble. I mean, you're like bubble lit. But if you are good looking and you can do, you know, be able to morph into whatever somebody needs to see, you're able to get in. Now, I would have been scared. I want to ask you, when you went into these places where you just kind of popped up, he popped up before pop-up was pop-up, and you were writing about, obviously, your book, you know, when you step upon a star. Is that right? When you step upon a star?
You got it. Yeah.
When you step upon a star. What made you come up with that kind of title? Is that part of your kind of apologizing? What happens when you do dirty, or you do dirt, or you step upon somebody that doesn't need to be stepped on? What made you come into that title?
Well, I want to answer that, but let me just go back a second. And I think you were paying me a compliment about how I look halfway decent.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, a lot of what I confess in my book is not only my tabloid tales, but I also confess about my own insecurities. And I spent quite a bit of money on plastic surgery.
Shut up.
To fit into what Hollywood was supposed to look like. And even before I worked at the Inquirer, I wanted to meet Victoria Principal from Dallas. So at the time, Victoria was married to the leading plastic surgeon in Hollywood, Dr. Harry Glassman, very, very skilled surgeon. Uh-uh. And so I booked an appointment with Dr. Glassman. I remember walking into his office and I passed a picture of Victoria in a beautiful sterling silver frame. And I ended up not only getting a nose job, but meeting Victoria Principal through that. So I there's another story in there about how I had a second nose job, and I ended up going on a double date with Drew Barrymore while I was still healing.
Drew.
Swollen, and she was giving me tips on how she had dealt with her plastic surgery procedures. So I confess everything, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I was ugly, and now I'm not so ugly. But that's thanks to a lot of surgeons in town. But it's also thanks to me coming into who I am.
Yeah, and maturing.
Now that I'm a happier person, now that I've trying to turn my life around, I think the inner happiness kind of comes out externally. So the title you're asking about, When You Step Upon a Star, my partner actually came up with this. We were on a dog walk and we'd thrown around a lot of different titles. And this was kind of perfect because it is me stepping on these people
literally,
who just wanted to sort of, you know, do make movies and make TV shows. But I was kind of sneaking into their personal lives and stepping on them for profit. And I got to say, I love the cover design. It's my foot coming down on one of these Hollywood Walk of Fame stars with a crack in it.
cracking the way to get inside and tell the truth.
Let me
ask you. So when I spoke about karma, you really understand what I'm talking about. 100%. And also, not only that, why don't you speak to us? Other than having some sort of conscience, which means that you're not a narc, you know, you've got some sort of heart and conscience, because a narc probably wouldn't have felt that way. But what brought you to the resounding awakening that you needed to get yourself together and with a quickness?
Well, what happened? A couple things. So I was spending a lot of time snooping into celebrities' private lives, but meanwhile, I was living a completely hypocritical life. Mm-hmm. I was deeply in the closet. My father had been in the closet. I was in the closet. So here I was sort of taking the focus away from me by focusing all on the private lives of Elizabeth Taylor and Britney Spears and Bruce Willis, and it goes on and on and on. So when I came to the decision that I wanted to get honest about my own life, my private life, I also in tandem realized I could no longer make a living on exposing the secrets of other people, famous or not. So me coming out went hand in hand with me quitting the Inquirer and trying to reestablish myself as a reporter. So it took a while. And yes, after the Inquirer, I went on to work for USA Today and TV Guide and People Magazine and Los Angeles Times. But what I found is, even though I quit the Inquirer, the tricks of the trade that I learned, the ways that I got secrets out of people, it was still in my blood. So I was still using those secrets on these celebrities to get these really sensationalized stories. And I was given more access than ever at USA Today. I didn't have to sneak into weddings. I was invited to weddings. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to sneak into the Oscars. I was given a ticket to the Oscars. So imagine somebody who still has some Inquirer blood in them, having access to all these people in their homes and dressing rooms and behind the scenes of their shows. It was a dangerous combination. And I made a lot of mistakes before I finally found the light.
And I'm happy that you found the light, because we need more people to find the light. The light is good. It's healing. Yeah. Come into the light, children.
You learn from your mistakes or you don't. And I did learn from my mistakes. And actually, every chapter, Osiris, ends with a lesson learned, something that helped me grow and evolve into a better human and journalist.
And you know what? And it's interesting how when we meet people at certain times in our life, when we are prepared to meet them. You know,
yeah.
I remember coming out of, you know, corporations like William Morris, which is why I asked that question about if you think that you had been a person of color or you had looked a certain way or whatever, would you have had the same reception? And I can tell you, I have been turned down so many times, and it took me a while. I'm like, what's wrong? Maybe I don't have enough education. No, you're educated. Maybe I don't have this. That. It took me a while to think that it might be because of the color of my skin. I'm telling you, because my mind doesn't go there. I'm a very, like, world based person. I've traveled a lot, been around a lot of different cultures, been in and out of different things. And so my mind, it took me a while to narrow my mind to make it that small. Because to me, people that think like that is small. Like, you could have so much more fun, you know, if you would just open up and engage with an entire environment versus, you know, just yourself and your own stuff. You know, it's not much to learn. And after a while, you know, it gets boring after a while, in my opinion.
You know? Absolutely.
What do you think, Will? You think the same thing?
Yeah, you just spend a time in a room talking about each other's sweaters and country club dues and, you know, all that nonsense. I mean, yeah, you know, I mean, it's, you got to step outside your safe little bubble and meet people who have their own exciting lives and have your, and challenge you to become a
better person. Mm-hmm. Did you yeah. have to go to therapy? Did you drink before you did? What did happen? Did you go through a drug period? Did you go through a hermit period? Did you go through, I need to pull away from everything, go off and see Swami Muktananda or somebody before you came back and said, okay, I'm ready to do this?
You know, sure. I mean, a lot of therapy. I have a chapter in the book about Courtney Cox from Uh-oh. Friends.
Not like Courtney.
I did an interview with Courtney soon after she gave birth to her first child about her postpartum depression. And in that chapter, I speak a lot about my own battles with depression and my interviews with Robin Williams. I had, I think, one of the last interviews with Robin before he took his life. So I was really able to kind of see that celebrities behind the publicist press releases in the studio gloss, they suffer just like we do. And now more than ever with social media, I mean, when somebody is going through something dark, we all know about it. And it was actually, I'll tell you, what actually led me to quit the Inquirer was I was on vacation. I hadn't seen what the cover of the new issue was going to be. And the new issue came out, and it was three really just dark stories. There was a photo about a morning talk show host who had lost her friend in a plane crash. Mm. There was a story that was trying to out Rosie O'Donnell as a lesbian. And then there was just a photograph of Raquel Welch, just looking kind of despondent. She was, I think, on a bridge looking down, like potentially you could have interpreted that as her wanting to jump off the bridge, but it was just a down day for her.
Yeah.
And I saw myself in each one of those stories.
Oh.
Like everyone else, I've suffered tragedy. I was living in the closet like Rosie was, and I certainly was battling depression or dark days like Raquel Welch was. And I said, you know what? This newspaper is evil. It's making its money off of people's pain and suffering.
Yeah.
And shortly thereafter, I turned in my resignation and tried to go legit.
Did you know William Blalock? Wasn't he the senior editor over there? Blalock?
No, I don't know that name.
Maybe he was. Is it Blalock or Block?
It could have been the Star or the Globe.
No, he was the senior editor. I thought his name was Bill Block or William Block or something like that. Maybe I'm wrong. Don't count me because it's been a long time ago. But the Inquirer, one reason I stayed away from stuff like that, not to say that, you know, there's I mean, Wendy Williams, there's a lot of people, you know, that do those kind of shows. I personally, because I understand karma and really what, because as a Buddhist, I don't play. I don't mess around. I don't want to talk. I think people have, we have enough negativity just trying to live a decent human life that jumps on top of us, attaches itself without putting a lot of stuff more. But until, like you said, when you're young and all of these things, you don't think about things in those kind of ways. It does take a sort of maturing in order to understand that those kind of things might be damaging someone else's life, you know.
For sure, for sure. And you know, I should also say that the moral dilemmas are just one part of the book. I mean, 90% of the book are these crazy
stories
that I took part in. And I wouldn't change it for a thing. I'm really glad I had those years at the Inquirer. It was a perfect time in my life. I was young and reckless. And I mean, I got to play spy. I got to play actor. I felt like James Bond, or like I was working for the mafia. And I came up with some really, really creative ways to get the stories I did.
What are some of the ways? Like, you're sitting in a room. Okay, I'm sitting in a room. I'm some young, unestablished. I was a stringer first, so you know where I've come from.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, so, but sitting in a room, I'm young, I'm vigorous, you know, or whatever you are. And you're trying to get out there and start something going. You're starting to get your name out there. What would you tell somebody, not you telling them, what did you tell yourself? I have a teeny head, you guys. My kids make fun of me and call my head chicken. It's a teeny head, like a little kid's. I wear baby gap hats from the Gap, even way. That's how little my head is. But anyway, so how did you talk the story through your own inner lens? Through the way you view them from the outside, not necessarily who they are as people, but from the outside looking in, all of our misconceptions or our perceptions about who these people are now that we have, now we have social media. I know people that talk about entertainers like they know these people personally based on what they're reading on the newspaper. Now, you and I know, because we're on the inside, that a lot of that, you know, like, come on now. You know, you just kind of agree to get off the phone. What do you think?
Sure.
Give your insight about that.
Well, I mean, at first you were asking about, you know, when I was first starting and sort of, you know, I guess advice I would give. And,
right.
You know, when people are writing a screenplay, they say, write what you know. And when I was starting out as a journalist, I actually never took a journalism course. I was working for Aaron Spelling. The
producer. Oh, yeah. I know who Aaron Spelling. Yes. Yes.
Love Boat and Fantasy Island. And I was given an opportunity to work for the Inquirer, and I focused on the things that I was curious and obsessed about. I was obsessed about the Brady Bunch. I loved the Brady Bunch. I started at the Inquirer, it was all about getting sources. And I had no sources. I didn't have anybody to call. So I came up with this idea to go to the actual Brady Bunch house and knock on the door and try to get a story. So what I knew was the Inquirer was, I thought at the time they were really interested in kind of like supernatural stories, like Elvis is alive. And
is he?
Well, I think so. I think, well, he would have been, he passed last year, actually. He lived a great life. I knocked on the door of the Brady Bunch house, and the owner answered. And I said, hey, I'm just curious if you ever hear any weird noises at night. Because Robert Reed, who played Mike Brady, the dad, he had recently died. And I thought maybe he was haunting the house. And she said, no, I don't know. No weird noises here. And I said, you sure you never hear like a vase knocked over? And because, you know, he hated doing the show and I could see how his ghost might be here haunting the house.
Mm-hmm.
She said, listen, I would tell you if he did. Sorry, nothing. So I said, all right, well, here's my card. If you hear of anything, let me know, because there could be some good money in it for you.
Uh-oh.
And she said, well, hold on. Now that you mention it, I have heard a couple. So I presented this story to my editors, and they were furious with me. They did not like that I'd made up this story. I think people think that all the Inquirer stories are completely made up. And some of them are, but I was brand new on the scene, and they didn't trust me yet. and they thought I was a mole trying to expose them as a magazine that just completely made up. So I almost got fired. I almost lost my job.
What saved it?
Well, the earthquake is what saved my job. It was 1994. I was about to be fired, and my apartment in Sherman Oaks was destroyed.
Oh.
And I had no place to live, and they decided to give me 3 more weeks before canning me.
Wow.
And in those 3 weeks is when I proved myself by getting some sources and showing that I was pretty fearless in terms of going out and getting stories. But what's great about the Brady Bunch story is it's the first chapter in my book, and I was lucky enough to get celebrities to comment on the different adventures I was in. So for that first chapter, I have Christopher Knight, who played Peter Brady, commenting on why so many people are obsessed with the Brady Bunch. And he writes some very funny things about me trying to expose a ghost inside the Brady Bunch house. So thank you, Christopher Knight, for contributing that. And just the first of many, many celebrities who contribute essays in my book.
But you also have, in my opinion, and this is just doing what I do, there is a certain kind of personality and a sense of purpose that one has to have, in my opinion, in order to go in there, lose all fear, lose all, you know, something that's going to happen or whatever. You just, it seems like your mind was just on target. I'm going after this. This is what I want, and I'm going to get it. And you also, again, you're good looking. You have a personality, you know, people warm up to you very easily. This is how people that are killers and people like this get people to, you know, induce them. I mean, it can be a blessing and a curse simultaneously, depending.
That'll be my next book, confessing my secret life as a serial
killer. behind the scenes, he's conjuring up ways to go in there. But don't you think that the fact that you were young and you were somewhat innocent, that people could sense that, and they helped you in a way. Let me help this kid, you know, get a
story. For sure, but I also just really wanted to meet these celebrities. I was a fan, and I really wanted to meet some of the older legends before they passed
away.
Yeah,
me too. I love that.
oh my gosh, who were your favorite legends? Maybe some that you got to meet before they died.
I met Ella Fitzgerald. She was sitting outside of the store in Beverly Hills. In Beverly Hills, she was sitting waiting on her driver. I also met some of the members of Earth, Wind, and Fire. I met other people through, because I was working for William Morris Talent Agency at the time, and they would all just come through the door. So I got to meet a lot of celebrities, and my boss, Gail Holcomb, who is still at William Morris and one of the partners there. Hey, Gail. Gail would let me, because she wanted, number one, to see women, and I was young African-American woman who was like very challenged with, how do I get myself outside of the box? Because I really like all of these things, but I'm scared that if I do this, then I'll be, you know, counter-docked by my own culture because I'm doing these things.
Yeah.
So she really helped me get in through the door, and she would give me her card and say, if you meet somebody, buy them something, buy them lunch, give them my number and have them talk to me. That's what she would do.
What a gift. What a gift. She must have really seen.
She saw things in me that I didn't see in myself. And I felt guilty because I jumped the gun way ahead, being impulsive and being a young mother and not really understanding, you know, what I needed to do to have that kind of career. But I got it now. I got it. I got it, Gail. You did a great job, girl.
You
developed me. You gave me a hell of a start. So anyway, but yeah, so back to you. Go ahead.
I was a natural snoop. I really, it wasn't like it took a lot of courage for me to sneak into weddings like Melissa Gilbert's wedding and Meredith Baxter Burney's wedding. I wanted to get in there and find out what it was going to be like in there, who was there. And I wanted to taste some of that free wedding cake. So I came up with some creative ways to get in there. One key I found is just to buy a gift and just mingle in with the other guests and look as though you belong there. And so for Meredith Baxter Burney, she played
Meredith
the mother
Baxter
on Family Ties. She was getting married. It was the last time she married a man before she decided to marry a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought a $5 picture frame at Target, but I wrapped it like it came from Tiffany in that baby blue wrapping paper with a nice white ribbon.
Yeah.
And it looked fancy. And so the reception was at the Bel Air Hotel, and I just mingled in with the other guests, you know, admiring the swans, and I smiled at the security guards, and I had a date, and I walked right in. And then when it was time to walk into the main reception room, my date and I just kind of mingled and talked until all the place cards had been taken except for two. Two were left. So we took those two name tags.
Oh, no.
We went to that table and we sat down, and people were asking, you know, how do you know the bride and groom? And we just kind of BS'd our way through it. And then when it was time for the cake cutting, I jumped up with the other family members. I took a picture of the cake cutting, and that picture ended up in that week's Inquirer.
Wow. So yeah. There's a little bit of good fortune too, that to me one has. There's a little bit of multiversal support here. You know, when you got a path and you help, you know, the life will help assist you if you're focused and you know where you're going. You're not going to get yourself in too much trouble, even if it's just to learn a lesson or not. It may be to find your fame and fortune, you know.
I view that one as a victimless crime. I mean, she had already ordered two more plates of roast beef. So it would be a shame if they had gone to waste. So we sat down in those empty seats and ate that food. No one got hurt. We contributed some fun to that table. And then her lovely wedding cake photo got in the Inquirer. And I like to think that she opened that $5 Target frame that I got her and clipped out that picture of her wedding cake cutting and put it in that.
She probably did, Will. She probably did do that. But what I'm saying is that I don't know. I don't think I've tried to do what you've done. And I don't know. It's like, okay, you know, I've got blind, you know, you can see me. I'm like, like a light on you, you know, you know what I mean? And it never happened for me. I had to go completely another direction, like running to people like Harlan, you know, and people like that years later, after I said, I don't want to do it. I'm tired of fighting all this stuff. And I don't know why I can't just go do this and that. I already had a background out of William Morris and the big corporations, Universal Music Group, et cetera, et cetera. But you were able to, in one way, you lie well. You lie well. That's what you're saying, that you have the ability. This is not a down on you, Will, because I love you already.
No, I get it.
I'm just saying you're able to appeal to, and his lies are not to, listen to me. There's a difference in lying to intentionally manipulate, hurt, and harm people. There's another lying that one can do in order to protect, in order to get something out of something that may do somebody else good. You know, Meredith Baxter, her wedding cake. Who don't want to see a wedding cake and somebody having fun and a good time? So it's not like, oh, yeah, there was a big shootout after the wedding, you know, like some of the other stuff that we're hearing in the news these days. But my question would be to you now, how easy do you think, could we do any of that stuff now? No, it's too much social media. They got cameras everywhere. Everybody's scared now because of Diddy, and they don't know who's recording them and who's doing this. What do we do? What?
Well, I mean, what we do if we're reporters is, I mean, you just mentioned the two kinds of lying. And I mean, without a doubt, mine was that first kind. I mean, I was manipulating. I was. I mentioned, I haven't made a joke about Meredith's wedding cake, but no, I did some pretty slimy things too. I was Dean Martin, the legendary crooner Dean Martin, part of the Rat Pack with Frank Sinatra. Mm-hmm. He passed away, and I was assigned to get into his funeral. And I went to the cemetery early, Westwood Memorial Park, and I was pretending to be just a mourner at a grave, and I was waiting, biding my time. But the VIP, the security guards came in and cleared out the grounds. Hmm. And so I was out of luck. So I was like, how am I going to get access to this funeral? And so I walked all around the perimeter of the cemetery. There was a big wall, and I saw that there was a tree that was growing from one of the neighbor's lawns. The branch was extending over the wall near the chapel where Dean Martin's service was taking place. So I went that tree and I rented his tree for a few hours. Mm-hmm. I paid him $500 and I was up in that tree along with my photographer. And we were able to look down over the lectern and see all up. Of course, it's leaf blowing day here at my house.
Oh, wow.
Always Thursdays.
So We can't hear anything.
Okay, good. Hopefully you can hear.
No, you're
so
fine.
I rented that plane, and I was up there, and I could see Frank Sinatra and Jerry Lewis, all of them, Angie Dickinson signing the guest book. And then after everyone went to the chapel, I was treated to my own little concert of Rosemary Clooney singing some of Dean Martin's favorite hits. So, I mean, I had fun with this. And a lot of times nobody even knew I was there until they read the stories in the Inquirer. And like, wait a minute. Who crashed our service? Who crashed our wedding?
Too late now. Yeah. Wow. But it sounds like fun. So when you did things like, I know you went to wedding funerals, but when you actually started talking to celebrities, I asked another writer this. How long did it take you to gain their trust? I mean, did some of them trust you right away? Did you have to use, I'm with the Inquirer and that's my calling card? Or was it just your own person and doing what you got to do to get the story?
Well, mostly when I was at the Inquirer, Osiris, I would not tell them who I was, or I was just doing things without them even being aware of my existence. But when I was sitting down for on-the-record interviews with USA Today or with People or with LA Times, I found that if I try to take away the borders of interviewer and celebrity, mm-hmm. if I try to make it just like a conversation, then both of us kind of relaxed, and that's when things got interesting. And I found that instead of me just grilling the person over and over again, if I shared some personal things about my own life, they appreciated that and they felt more comfortable sharing things about their lives. And then before they knew it, we were talking like friends. And then sometimes they would see the story that I wrote in the paper and like, wait a minute, I didn't even realize I was saying that.
Oh no.
But yeah, so I mean,
wow.
That's one of the tricks of the trade that worked well for me. And it wasn't manipulative. It was really just me trying to
do your job. You were trying to do your job.
Do my job.
You're trying to do your job.
Get an interesting story for the readers.
Yeah, you were trying to do your job. I remember when I worked for Ray Charles when I was really young. I had this job working for Mr. Ray Charles and James Brown. And Mr. Brown had two companies, James Brown East and James Brown West. And there was a woman named Vonnie Sweeney. Some of you might remember Vonnie, whoever those people out there that might remember. But both of the artists, Mr. Brown would always, he'd only talk to certain kinds of reporters. And they had to talk to him when he wasn't with any of his friends, female or whatever, his staff. And then they also had to talk to him when he was going right before going onto the show, because it would get him all fired up to go and do his thing,
Wow.
And Kenny, so he would want to, it was a part of him being stimulated. Like to stimulate and go on the show. Yeah, he's going to talk to somebody. They're going to go on stage and do his thing. Mr. Charles was like the opposite. Number one, he was real laid back. And the people that were coming to the studio, they would come over to his studio versus Mr. Brown, who lived somewhere else. Because Mr. Brown was out of Atlanta. And so Mr. C was here. His whole company was here in L.A. So it was a whole different mindset that people would have when they come and talk to him because he was local than when they do what they do when they talk to Mr. Brown. And it's different how each one of them have their own little personal things about how they want the interview to be, who they want to interview, how they want to talk to them, and that kind of thing.
I know that one of the challenges when I was working as a so-called legit reporter is the power of the press. Years ago, the press had all the power.
Yeah.
I mean, they could make and break careers. And
them and Johnny Carson.
Now that magazines and newspapers aren't selling well, they're really at the mercy of the studios in terms of the interviews that they're granted.
What do you mean?
So, I mean that the take TV Guide. Years ago, TV Guide was the number one selling magazine, and its reach was so vast that the studios were willing to take the chance of giving TV Guide full access to their sets and their stars, even though the article could be potentially negative. It was worth the gamble. And I remember that some of the old TV guides I read they would go to the set of Laverne and Shirley and just wrote kind of this scathing article about how things were so, there was so much friction backstage between the actresses playing Laverne and Shirley. Well, now, if there was a contentious set like that, they would never allow any press to visit. And I talk about Desperate Housewives. I was the reporter who was granted more access than any other to the set of Desperate Housewives. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I kept all the secrets that I knew were happening there. And three of the actresses from Desperate Housewives, Marcia Cross, Eva Longoria, and Felicity Huffman,
okay,
by the end of the show, were no longer speaking to Terry Hatcher. And so when they were filming the final episode, they didn't allow any press on set except for me. I was there for the final tape day. And I saw how when they would yell cut, three of the ladies would go in one direction and Terry would go off in the other direction. And I actually reported this in my final story in TV Guide. And I give credit to my editor, actually, for letting me tell it as it was, because ABC was not thrilled that I was exposing that, but that's the way it had been for a long time. And I felt it was sort of just time to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. But there are instances where editors will be so under the control of the studios that they will let the studios dictate which reporters can cover which shows and which movies. And that takes all the power away from the press. Because if the reporter knows, gee, if the publicist doesn't like me, if they're mad at something I write, I better write safe stories. I better only write stories that they'll like, or else I'll be out of a job. And that's what's happening now.
And how would you, but how are you going to read somebody's mind and know what they might like? And that's unfair, because every individual person has their own, or should have their own mindset and their own perspective, along with following the guidelines of whatever media outlet you're reporting for. Right now, I think, don't you think as well, Will, that they're looking for authenticity? So for somebody that's out there just following, what everybody else writes, is boring already. You need to be able to come up creatively come up with some ways to tell your story without trying to rip somebody off or take what someone, it's already been done. It's rhetorical. Find something new to do. You guys are the ones living out here in the new age. So find some new age stuff to do, that's going to work, for what's going on now. Don't you think so?
Well, I think that again, social media has taken the power away from the press completely, mm-hmm, because the celebrities, whether it's Beyonce or Jennifer Lopez or Taylor Swift, years ago, they would have relied on magazines and newspapers and Entertainment Tonight to have the public learn what they were about and to get a preview of their concert or their movie. Mm-hmm. But now that's all done through their own social media.
That's right.
They can let people have first looks at their concert or their movies. They can let people know, gee, I'm about to get divorced. Please respect my privacy during this time. So the only reason they would ever do any business with a magazine or a show like Entertainment Tonight is if they knew 100% it was going to be fluff and positive.
Okay.
Otherwise, if there's a risk there of them exposing something nasty, then they're like, forget it. I don't need you. I'll just use my own social media platform of 900 million followers to get the word out. I don't need your small audience at all. So it's, things have completely changed, which has taken the power away from the press.
And I like that. I like that we're taking more responsibility for things, and it does give more of ways for individuals to express themselves. We're getting close to ending the show, so I want to plug again, we have a sponsor, Kevin Pike. Of Coldwell Banker, decided to take a chance on little old me and my show, and we are kicking butt. Don't forget, he is a certified senior real estate and probate specialist for Coldwell Banker. His numbers are 818-571-1508. Again, Kevin Pike, probate specialist. And he works with the elderly and people like that, too. So whatever you got going, Kevin can deal with it. Don't worry. Again, his number, Coldwell Banker, is 818-571-1508. And now back to our guest, Will Keck. I want to know, Will, where can we find you? What are the other books you're working on? I know we want to read When You Step Upon a Star. You'll never know where you're going to be where you are.
You know, I guess I want to thank a lot of the celebrities who, because I decided for a variety of reasons, including legal reasons, to share the chapters with the celebrities before I went to press, before I published the book. Mm-hmm. So some of them gave me their blessings, some didn't respond, but several of them decided to write essays from their perspective on what it was like dealing with me back in the day.
Oh.
So for instance, I just talked about Desperate Housewives, mm-hmm. Marsha Cross, who played Bree on the show, she wrote a lovely commentary about a very uncomfortable situation that we had had. Melissa Gilbert, I crashed her wedding from Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah.
She writes a nice page about what it's been like dealing with me and forgiveness. So people like Cybill Shepherd, and the book is scattered with essays from celebrities who knew me then and now got to know me later
now.
As a legit reporter and producer. So I want to thank all of them. And yeah, the book's been doing very well on Amazon. You can order it on Amazon. You can get it on Kindle. It's available at barnesandnoble.com.
Everywhere.
Apple Books also has it. So it's really an interesting journey of somebody who was doing some very nasty things, who learned from those mistakes, and luckily was given a chance to become a different, better man. And some crazy stories in there about stealing Kelsey Grammer's garbage.
I remember Kelsey. I think one of the quotes Kelsey Grammer, let me see if I can remember. He said that this young man in hell should fry, but that's probably a done deal already.
Boy, I'm impressed. You were looking at anything and you almost got it. So Kelsey, in his book, Kelsey wrote a book. In his book, he called me a despicable piece of flesh who he invited to burn in hell. Your mother must be very, very proud. And you can get Kelsey's audiobook and you can hear him speak about me in his Fraser Crane accent, which I was absolutely thrilled about.
And then also Henry Winkler had something. I love Henry Winkler. He's always going to be cool. But listen, we need your social media tags because it's getting time for us to close out. And I want people to hit you up. And then if you want to run your mouth, we can always talk.
Okay. Well,
I love it.
So the title of the book is When You Step
Upon a Star.
When you step upon a star, that is how you find it on Amazon. That is my Instagram. That's my Facebook. All my different handles are When You Step Upon a Star. You can find me through that. My website, whenyoustepuponastar.com, has sample chapters you can read, and you can reach out to me. I would love to hear from people to see what they like and what they don't like.
And it's juicy, you guys. It's juicy. If you want some good stuff.
Yeah,
some great stuff. And these are good stories. I want to really say quickly, these are really good stories because they're not all just tainted with drugs and sex and all that. These are real life human stories that people have been able to capture, which is why I'm so into nostalgia and the old classic Hollywood. Don't forget about me. I am on IG as Osiris_Munir_the painter. And don't forget about my sponsor, Kevin Pike of Coldwell Panker, 818-571-1508. And certainly don't forget about my new best friend, Will Keck, and his wonderful book,
hey.
When You Step Upon a Star. Remember when you step upon a star? You don't know how far you might go.
So delighted to be on your show. What a gift. What a holiday gift this was.
Oh, this is fun. And I got to bring out the end the year with the upbeat with somebody that I absolutely adore. And Harlan, I can't thank you enough. Your people are badass. And Will, you want to say bye? Happy holidays, everybody. We will see you. I've got another show before the year ends, but I'll see you next week. It'll be after Christmas, but we're still will air on Thursdays. And I love you all. And thank you. And don't forget, a smile works wonder. Bye-bye.
The show with Osiris Munir, only on LA Talk Radio.